you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You guys want to be in a documentary?
I'm George Shin, and you're listening to SupDoc, a show where we talk to our friends about the world of documentary film. And today, returning guest, Daniel Gill, back in the house. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. I've seen you more recently than I've seen Paco, actually, because we saw each other last night.
Yeah, well, I didn't even think about the fact that you would probably be at The Smell, but you were there.
Dude, I was there two nights in a row. I was there.
I thought maybe possibly where you weren't there three nights in a row.
Well, I was kind of getting guilted into going tonight to go see the Def Club Black Dice guys. Show.
Right.
But
yeah.
Right now I'm recording this. We'll see if I have any energy to do three nights at The Smell, which I don't think I've ever done in my life.
That's a lot.
That's asking a lot. And speaking of being old and going to rock shows,
yeah.
Today, Dan, we are here to talk about, this is a film from 2022. It's Meet Me in the Bathroom, directed by Will Loveless and Dylan Southern, who I guess also made the LCD film, which
yeah, shut up and play the hits.
Yeah. And it's based on the oral history of the early aughts, turn of the century, New York rock scene that was written by Lizzie Goodman, which is Meet Me in the Bathroom. So I have to admit, I did not read the book. Did you read the book?
Okay. Yes. I think that's an important, I mean, the book is great. I'll just say that the book, you should read the book. I mean, okay. It's basically like, I think Lizzie kind of modeled it after Please Kill Me. Mm-hmm. In that it is a completely just quote-based oral history. She doesn't really have her own opinion about things. Mm-hmm. There's nothing of her, you know, it's basically just quotes, just interview quotes, the name of the person speaking and their quote, but in mm-hmm. a very methodical, not completely chronological, but mostly chronological way. And it's very like bare bones, but it works really well. I read it in like an afternoon. It was such a fast read. It's a really long book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, considering.
And you were around for some of it, right? So that makes sense.
I lived in New York. Yeah, I lived in New York from the summer of 2002 till late 2004. Mm-hmm. Which is, I mean, the book kind of starts a little bit before that. I mean, I was not in New York for 9/11. Basically, 9/11 happened, and I was living in Colorado, and my boss at the time was like, we should move to New York. Rent will be cheap.
Oh, God.
I would say I'm
happy to represent someone who didn't read the book and is coming to the film as a film.
Right.
But right. At the same time, I do have my own baggage with this scene or with this material, like, you know, thinking about this entire music sub. I don't, this is like, doesn't feel like a music subculture in a way. It, I mean, it's right. Spawned from a subculture, but it became the mainstream culture, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to somebody else about it last night, and it's kind of like, well, there were so many bands and actually so many kind of micro scenes happening in New York at the same time, and a lot of those don't even get a mention. It's really just, I mean, essentially, this is the story of the most popular bands to come out of that time period in New York, which is the Strokes, the Yeah Yeahs, the LCD, Interpol. A little bit of TV on the Radio and the Liars, only because they were in the kind of same orbit as Yeah Yeahs because of Dave Siddick. But
And the Rapture,
and the
and
Rapture, and by the ever the Rapture, DFA, all that stuff. But there was a lot of other things happening in New York. I mean,
for sure.
Freak Folk was happening at the same time in New York. And you had
Improv music, like, yeah, there's like
Electro Clash. I mean,
Electroclash, yeah.
hello. That was
Yeah.
huge. There could be
Yeah.
a whole other, I mean, they could honestly do a whole other book and movie just about Electro Clash, and it would probably be pretty interesting.
I'm interested in the way you can kind of slice and dice this sort of segment, right? Like it's sort of like you could write a lot of these could be spun out into their own things or like made into like a a 7-part series or something. But
Yeah.
well, this is what I was like thinking about watching this. I'm like, is that a false premise? Or like is it Kimya Dawson saying we couldn't imagine there'd be like, or I don't know if it was Kimya, someone said it was hard to imagine like New York producing like vibrant rock bands again. And like
Right.
that's never been my thought about that. It might just be that other genres were dominating in the 90s and coming up. And like, yes, there was like, I guess they kind of show like Blink 182 and Offspring and being like West Coast sort of was like power pop, punk pop, and like nu metal were like what was in the air at the time. Maybe there weren't many
And
new metal bands from New York.
I think that's the thing. It's like most of, yeah, none of those bands were from New York. You can't really think of a famous grunge band from New York.
Right, I'm trying to think. In late 90s, what there was like, okay, there was a lot of bands that were like, oh, this is also the period, like if you think of the late 90s, right, we're thinking maybe like starting 95 post Cobain's death, maybe.
Yeah.
There was also this period where there's a purity about like what is an indie label and what is a major label. And like there were like these kind of hybrid things where it's like it's an indie label, but it's run through major distribution or like Vernon Yard or something like that, right? They put out like the Low Records or just or like Z Zero Hour. Does that ring a bell? Like
Yes.
labels that were like ostensibly indies, but were clearly just kind of like a cut, like a just a minor league farm team for majors.
So, well, I should point out that in the book, Lizzie starts by talking about Jonathan Fireeater, who were not even, well, they were kind of like a, they were from Washington, D.C., but also had New York ties.
Yeah.
And they would play in New York a lot. And they turned into the Walkmen, basically.
Right.
So, and the Walkmen were definitely a New York band. But so she kind of starts the book by talking about how Jonathan Fireeater was the band that kind of lit the fuse that sparked the situation to arise for the Strokes and all these bands to exist. And I think there's also a quote from Julian in the book where he says, I would just go see like the Mooney Suzuki play. Do you remember the Mooney Suzuki?
Yes, in fact, that I recently became acquaintances with one of the members of Mooney Suzuki who lives in LA. And the
Okay.
first thing I saw last time I saw him, first thing I was like, did you see the movie? And he's like, nah, but we're quoted in the book. Like I'm quoted in the
Yeah.
book, is
Yeah,
what he
he is
said.
quoted. He's quoted in the book, and there's this great quote from Julian where he said, when I started the Strokes, I really just wanted to have a band that was as cool as the Mooney Suzuki, which I
Yeah.
don't even really think like me, like I wasn't really living in New York at the time. The Mooney Suzuki was around playing a lot. I think there was, they kind of were, I don't
They would
know,
have been
just
kind of
before.
like the band that opened for the Makeup is like what
Yes,
they would have
exactly.
been. Yeah. And like
I didn't
kind of
really.
cop that style a little bit, like the
They were
sharp
doing
suit.
more of a straight up retro garage kind of vibe.
Yeah.
And that's
I hope we've not lost everyone. If you're not down with these last few minutes of this podcast, it's going to be very deep references to a lot of 90s and 2000s music. So this is a bread and butter of What's Up, Doc. Yeah. It's like guys in their 40s jabbing about the past. And this this should be something I love. I feel conflicted about a few things about this film. I felt like the gratuitous like 9/11 footage. I don't know. Did it feel gratuitous to you? It felt gratuitous to me. It felt like,
okay. I mean, that's like, a fair point. I just felt like, for me, I was watching it and I was like, how did they even get this footage? Who was filming the Strokes walking around in the ashy aftermath of 9/11?
Oh yeah, like Paul from Interpol is like walking around in the dust, like picking up files and stuff. Yeah,
right. Like this was a very weird thing to be like, we should film this. I don't know. But that also goes back to the point of like, okay, so two points I wanted to make. First of all, I think when they initially were planning this film, they were going to make it into a series.
Okay.
It wasn't originally going to be a standalone documentary. It was going to be like a Hulu series or something. Then second of all, they made a choice, a very clear choice, to only use archival footage. They didn't film anything new for the film. They just used archival footage that they were able to source from bands, managers, labels, fans, the internet, whatever. So they put all that together. I mean, I think Vice themselves, who produced the movie, were filming a lot at the time. I remember seeing a Vice film crew kind of following around the Yeah Yeah Yeahs backstage at a show that I was at. Or actually, it was at the parking lot show that's in the film.
Oh yeah, that show, right?
That was a legendary moment.
That's 2002, and the Liars get short shrift in this film as well. I would say. Like they're pretty important in that scene.
Yeah,
I mean, I love the quote.
Go ahead.
Oh, the quote from I think it's Brian Chase. He's like, the big bands were Oneida, Liars, Sightings. And I feel like there's one other one that's like not really given a lot of attention in the doc, but like, I'm like, yeah, like,
I mean, in TV on the Radio was like, they were like probably the hardest working band of this whole scene. Yeah. I remember just like seeing them so much in the early period of that band, and they were literally playing more than one show a day.
Wow.
In New York, they were playing an afternoon show. And then like walking down the street and playing an evening show and maybe playing another set at like 1 in the morning at like Lit or something.
Like, I guess, yeah.
I saw them play at a coffee shop. Okay. Like that's the kind of thing they were doing. And they were already signed to Touch and Go at this point. Like they were determined to like become, well, I think they were just mainly trying to become a better live band, which they did pretty fast. I saw them grow by leaps and bounds from the first time I saw them till, you know, the actual major label album came out. It was like a different band.
I always wanted to make music when you're the offspring of immigrants. And you say, I want to be an artist. You might as well say, thanks for all of this, but I'm going to put on a pair of clown shoes. But I gotta get whatever energy that's in me out.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Given the constraints, I put myself in two shoes. It's like, I also like wouldn't want the job of putting all this together. And like, how do you cram like seven bands' stories together? And the kind of chorus of really, logic is Kimya Dawson.
It would have been probably, I mean, I think they had enough material to work with to turn it into a seven-part Hulu series, but maybe the execs at or whatever, whoever was behind funding this was kind of like, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. It's not far enough away as like when they did like, you know, there've been other, like they did the Wu-Tang thing. That was like,
oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. They did the Wu-Tang kind of like drawn out bioseries. There's so many characters in that as well. But that's part of my thought about just the whole thing. It's like, almost all these people are still actively doing music and right. Like they kind of like, of course it's like we covered the ones that were biggest because they're the ones that people know. And then that isn't, it's a circular thing of like, therefore mm-hmm. then they get the most, it's like when when a rock doc is about how the rock doc, like the beginning of the rock doc is always, we were just a bunch of friends. We met in college. We met at a coffee shop. And then by the time they're like, then we were in England and like people were throwing panties at us. And like for the Strokes, that just all happened in a year. That was the thing that was insane about it.
Or just like in a couple months or something.
Yeah. Bizarrely. So I don't know. I guess that I was saying to you, like my frustration is like even just hearing like the Interpol being like, well, we were kind of living in the shadow of those guys. I'm like, well, you ended up being Interpol. It's fine for you. Like, I was comparing it to the movie, the Doc Comedian with Seinfeld, and how Orny Adams is like the guy who's I'm struggling under being a new band, and you know. But I guess it's like, yeah, everyone has like their own kind of cross to bear, like the thing that they sort of are living under. Like Interpol seemed like they had a lot of darkness going on, actually. But I like the music from Interpol. I think feel like that stuff held up pretty well out of all these bands.
I'm not sure if they really got a chance to tell their full story again. They were another band that kind of became like major. They were major players in that world, but they were kind of sidelined in the film a little bit.
They're like a foil. They're like the foil to be
the
like,
foil to the Strokes or something.
Right, yeah. But then they still end up being like fine in the end.
Everyone got major label deals. Everyone made a lot of money. It's all fine. There's no sob story, really.
Was Moldy Peaches major label? I kind of wasn't super. I feel like
they blew up. I'm not really counting.
You're not counting them.
I'm counting the major.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
For the you know, we have the Strokes, the AAS, Interpol, LCD, Rapture. All those bands got major label deals.
Right. Just the other day, I kind of came across Luke Jenner's Instagram. I was telling you about it. How?
Oh, right.
Like a life coach.
Yeah.
I just kind of also because like the Rapture started in San Francisco, and like my friend Brooks used to be in the band for a while. I remember they moved to Seattle for a minute, and then I remember when they moved to New York, and that was probably like 98, 99 that they moved to New York. And they used to just be in this apartment in the Mission, but I didn't really know them at the time. Some stuff that Luke posted on the website for Meet Me in the Bathroom is talks about like his mom's like mental health and like she and suicide, and like so he's been posting a lot about like a lot of personal growth stuff and like.
And now he's like, a life coach, right?
Yeah, and like the stuff he's been posting about is like probably from like this angle of like partying a lot, being, you know, super inebriated, getting sober, and then also like having your whole ego tied into this, you know, machine of like,
yeah,
you know, other people validating you.
I did. I guess like one thing I'll point out is that, the DFA LCD section of the film, which has come sort of later in the film, was one of the more interesting parts to me.
Me too.
And it also had things in there that were not in the book that I learned fresh from the film, such as them kind of like when they started, they decided, well, we're going to start a label. We need to find a band to be on our label. That's not right. just our own stuff.
Right.
Like they had LCD was obviously going to be on the label from the get-go. And they just kind of like stumbled across the Rapture, who had just moved to New York. Right. And then they're like, we can mold these guys, you know, like, you can kind of like see that evil glare, that evil glint in James Murphy's eye. Like, I know what to do with this band.
Yeah. I mean, he's a fascinating character in the story. I feel like, because like, also like Julian's kind of interesting, but he doesn't articulate very much like what is going on with him. So there other people are like, oh yeah, he felt conflicted. But like with James Murphy, he's so like verbose and like also in my eyes are like relatable because he is a cynical guy who's just sort of like, I've been beating my head against this wall for like 30 years. And like, now I'm like, for all these other people are getting this thing. And why am I not getting it? And you know, that kind
of thing. I even remember at the time, you know, I was in my mid 20s, but like thinking like, oh, this guy is starting a new band and he's like 37. And I was thinking, isn't that a little late or a little old to be like starting a brand new band and trying to like, you know, be part of this scene that's happening of all these 20-year-olds. Right. So in a way it was like LCD was like, going against all odds. They had the odds, you know, like the odds were not really in their favor. To be a successful band. And even I love that scene where he plays Losing My Edge for his partner.
Yeah.
And he's like, don't release this. This is embarrassing. This is cringy. Like he's like, this is like making me cringe. And James is like, I am putting this out. I don't really care what you say. Like, this is it. This is it for me. I'm ready to go. Like, this is, it's go time for me, like now or never. So like,
yeah.
And then of course that song is iconic now.
Yeah. I mean, it is representing a truly cringy feeling, but then like in other media that's become good, right? Like that around the same time, it's like mumblecore, right? It's like expose your vulnerability, like you throw it all out there, you know, like you're the Paul Giamatti of post-punk or whatever, you know? I found that fascinating too. I did a little research subsequently. I knew there was some stuff going on in the business end of DFA, and it seemed like they never had the business end super like buttoned down, but like him and Tim Goldsworthy had a big falling out. And I know this other label, 4-4, I believe, is the other guy that used to be involved in DFA. So he was really good at like having like kind of a manifesto and like a thing to tie everything together and an aesthetic and like good taste. But it seems like, one of those things where, you know, then it doesn't necessarily all work out business wise, or like not everyone can get along and sustain that kind of thing when there's clearly like this leader who's also an artist on the label.
Yeah.
That's a lot of it.
And then it also, the whole thing with them doing their fake out breakup, you know, the last show ever and kind of like tricking all their fans to flying to New York and coming to Madison Square Garden for that show. And then like 2 years later, okay, we're back.
I
mean, it was like planned
Jay-Z's
out.
Done that, right?
Well, it was just, I think it was planned out very methodically. Like we're going to go away, announce that we're breaking up, and then just wait for that Coachella offer to go up to $1 million or whatever.
Like he's very Machiavellian. He's like, you think he has a long-term,
it was a long-term plan. It was from the get-go. Like he always intended to bring it back.
He kids, right? Like that's not like the way he's portrayed in a lot of stuff. It's like not that calculating. It like is the brand is not to be that calculating and to be more.
Oh, it had to be roughy. It had to be.
Yeah. So I also, Nick Zinner was a guy who was just around New York, like in like 99, 2000, like I would like go anywhere in New York and just see Nick Zinner, where it's like, it's a bar, it's a restaurant, it's a show, he's DJing,
me too,
he's bartending, he's just around. I'm just like, I remember this. Yeah.
There you would be at a party and then just like him and Connor Oberst would like wander in together and you'd be like, these guys again.
But this is I was thinking before this band started, like I saw some other band he was in at like a Halloween party or something. Mm-hmm. I can't tell if this is a false memory that's planted in me because of this film or not, but I'm like, I do remember seeing the White Stripes at the Mercury Lounge. So I may have been at that first Yeah Yeah Yeahs show, but I cannot for the life of me remember ever seeing the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Like maybe they were like, maybe they played, maybe I caught like the last song or something. Or I remember hearing something about them at the time. Yeah. Because that was in 2000. Yeah.
Saw them a lot when I lived in New York. They would play a lot. They would just play all the time. And they kind of got to be the de facto opening band for anyone cool that was playing in New York. Like, I think there's a story of like they played, either John Spencer saw them or they opened for John Spencer in New York and he fell in love with them and said, I want you to do my entire world tour with opening for me.
Wow.
That was their first tour, I believe, outside of New York. And then they also, I think I saw them open for Sleater-Kinney for sure at Irving Plaza. It was an amazing show. And of course, how do you follow Karen O? I don't know why they would want her to open for them, because she blew them off the stage. Mm-hmm. And then I think they opened for the White Stripes again at a bigger venue. I know they opened for them at the Mercury Lounge, and I think they opened for them many other times too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they would play a lot. I saw them many, many times. I remember just having this moment when I saw them play there used to be a thing called the Siren Festival. That was a free outdoor festival at Coney Island that the Village Voice would curate. And Yeah Yeah Yeahs played that and Liars and a bunch of the other bands from the movie. I don't know why there isn't footage of that in the film, because I know people filmed it. But I remember standing way in the back of the field or whatever where the show was. And you could see Karen O's smile even when you were like a half a mile away from her. Wow. And I was like, this girl is going to be very famous.
Right.
Like that was just like really early on, you know, like before the major label album, before she was just like that magnetic on stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she sort of represent, I think she's the main female, you know, representation in the film. Talks about like how the sort of male gaze of the press and like people trying to like take photos up her skirt when she's performing and stuff like that. And that's like sort of seems like she is like, I felt very alone. I even my bandmates weren't going through the same stuff I was going through. And having this very large persona, being clearly a focal point of this band and being sort of fetishized. You know, so that was like, I think, important to include. And I think it was really draining her, ability to keep going for a while. That's kind of the impression that I had. Seems like she's had to step back, and then now they're back and fully doing stuff again. But like, for your mental health, like that lifestyle of touring and having everything scrutinized and being in your face constantly has got to be draining.
Yeah, for sure. And that band like broke up and got back together, broke up and got back together about 30 times in that within the course of those years, and I'm sure many other times later on. It was a very like volatile thing. I was actually going back and reading some of their interviews prepping for this, just to kind of like make sure I had the facts straight with them. But like Brian and Karen went to Oberlin together and didn't meet Nick until they moved to New York.
Yeah.
And he went to Bard College. So, but everyone in the film pretty much went to either an Ivy League school or Wesleyan or Oberlin.
Oh yeah, I think not. I don't think Luke or Vito did, but I didn't. One of the Rapture guys, I think, might have been an Oberlin guy. Or I remember this band that what maybe Gabe was in or Maddie was in called ABCs. Mm-hmm. They were like a accordion, saxophone, drum trio. It was like right. Someone from Rapture ended up being in that band. Yeah, that's just kind of like a lot of people I met in New York around that time were people that had been to like, yeah, like Wesleyan or something. It's just like it's proximity and or Bard or something like that, or Brown. And like a lot of right. those people like just gravitated to New York. So it was a lot of people like that were very highly educated in their early 20s that were like trying to create some kind of artistic impact. I mean, I'd say a parallel thing at the time that I was kind of more interested was like the Providence scene, which yeah. I kind of like really discovered around the year 2000 also, like all like.
And that was all RISD kids.
Yeah, like the Load Record scene, Airborne Radar, all that stuff. Yeah. I think like, yeah, class is an interesting element of this. It's like sort of like just, it's a not really delved into. It's sort of like, you know, it's clearly like they, oh, we moved to Brooklyn. Oh, it was cheap. And then
right, with the, there's only really,
priced out, you know,
there's really only one minor moment in the film that kind of deals with that, which is the Nardwar scene.
Yeah. Nardwar. Wow. Going hard.
Which, yeah, he kind of like, you know, asked the Strokes about the Swiss boarding school where they all met each other. And they were kind of like, oh, we found out, you know, like,
well, yeah, Nardwar does his research.
Yeah, he does. His research department is unmatched, of course. We all know this. I would say like that moment is thrown in there to be like, we're acknowledging the class thing, but mm-hmm. we're not going to spend too much time talking about it because it's not that interesting. Yeah. I mean, like, it's like anyone who's starting a band and also having to you know, pay New York rent has to have funding coming from somewhere.
Yeah, like, was thinking about the practice spaces back then were like you would get like hourly practice spaces, right? Like that, like you had to be really hooked up to have like a practice space where you kept all your
stuff.
If you were in Manhattan,
for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so the class thing is sort of like subtly in there, but it's also like I think like it's like, is this like sort of like the last dying breath of like when rock music was like the you know, like rock is like sort of, it's back, rock is back in like the early 2000s. And that's sort of like now it's just so many other genres exist to think about.
Right.
That I think it's like that's maybe the main thing. It's like, yeah, the sort of like model that was like an indie rock kind of model just became mainstream in this time period. And like now it's like I don't know that like there's like underground rock, there is metal, there's punk, there's all this stuff, but like I feel like in the mainstream it's like it's just like, oh, the Foo Fighters or something. Like I don't know, I mean there's obviously there's more popular current rock bands, but it's just like it's just one option out of all the options that exist.
Yeah,
I think that's what's the difference.
There's also I would also mention that the book goes a little bit wider outside of New York. There's like a chapter called The Rest of the Rock Revival Bands that's like covers the Killers and even like Kings of Leon and the White Stripes and bands like that. So it does kind of like acknowledge that this was like a thing that was happening beyond just New York. It is kind of odd that all this stuff happened around the same time period, but I do think there was maybe just something in the air that was like, we should cash in on this while this is happening.
Well, yeah, I'm trying to remember back to that time. Like, I think it was maybe the Interpol guys saying like the magazines weren't covering this, like the press wasn't covering this. And like, I feel like I could push back on that because it does feel like New York media cares about things happening in New York and like they've just found something in their backyard they could just like, you know, I think they ran with it. Obviously it became that way maybe like at the very beginning. Sure, yeah, like if you're playing Brownies maybe you're not getting write-ups, right? But then the fact that they're
they were all getting very good press. That was a total lie. Yeah.
Yeah. That was like, I'm like, I think this is like not actually the case. And especially being from other markets, like if you're a market like San Francisco, like there's like three places you get written about in San Francisco. So like
it also helped.
York, there's so much more. Yeah.
It helped that the Strokes went over to the UK and timed it just right so that they would be like on the cover of the NME right at the time that they were doing their first tour over there. And of course that's partially Rough Trade.
Yeah.
Who, you know, signed them before anyone else signed them. And Jeff Travis being able to call in and to the NME and say, "Hey, I have your new cover stars. They're right here. Look at the way these guys look. You don't want to put them on the cover?"
I would love to have seen more from Jeff Travis or anyone more from the management side or something, just because it's like they just like the Strokes were like these man children that were like just doing drugs and running through the streets. And like, well, there clearly people were making money off of them, and there's like more like of the business side of it happening, and they seemed kind of like oblivious or like frustrated by it. I don't know. I think to me that's interesting. That's why I found the DFA stuff interesting. It's like what that was the only label that was talked about. I mean, it's an artist and a label, but with the Strokes having management, I'm it's a lot to jump around because there's actually a lot going on in here. So then there's sort of like the introduction of the film is Moldy Peaches, and they sort of touch on the anti-folk scene.
Yeah.
Which is a whole thing that it goes back to the 80s, I think, in New York, or even earlier than the 80s.
The Sidewalk Cafe was like a very specific scene in New York that spawned Moldy Peaches and Regina Spektor and Jeffrey Lewis and people like that. And that was very specific, like only the people who hung out at this one bar at this one time period and all kind of like, you know, had a very simple, like, I guess if you really want to talk about it, like they had a sensibility that was shared, but the sound, like Regina Spektor doesn't sound anything like the Moldy Peaches, so it's not like they sounded alike. They were just all friends and hung out of this one bar. So it was this thing that came out of that one very specific moment. Just like the, you know, Electro Clash was all centered around like this one bar, Lux, that was in Brooklyn. And I mean, it spread beyond that for sure, but that was like ground zero for it.
I'm also like, would you say that should Todd P have been in this, or is Todd P too underground by the time this has happened? Because like I think of that time period, like mid-2000s New York, it's like Todd P is like a thing that is like important.
I think, okay, so this brings up two important points again. First of all, since you haven't read the book does a lot better job of including the voices of people in the industry, managers, publicists, label people. Todd P himself, I believe, is in it. And so that it kind of gets lost in the film. Really only maybe like Ryan Gentles, the manager of the Strokes, and maybe a couple other like voices heard in the film that are not actually the musicians. Who else? I didn't rewatch it just like in the past week. So
yeah, I think that's the only one that I remember. That's like someone who's, or then I guess the only like one. DFA, like I guess like the other, you know, DFA representing a label. That was about it. Yeah.
That's about it. But in the book, there was like a guy that I knew, Asif Ahmed, who managed most of the bands other than the Strokes. He's in the book heavily. I would say he's kind of like sort of like the villain of the book in a way, or at least that's like.
he's set up that way.
To be set like, up that way.
The pure artist, and then like besides, the one,
besides Ryan Adams. Ryan Adams.
Oh, God, we do need to talk about Ryan.
Yeah, we have to talk about him at some point. Maybe let's wait a second. Let's finish this thought. But I believe that there was something like where like that parking lot show gets wrongly credited to Todd P. He was not the organizer of that show. It was somebody else, and I forget the name. Fact check, I'm not going off my notes. I don't have any notes here. I'm just going off my memory. But there was somebody else who actually put on that parking lot show. It was not Todd Pien. So, but basically right around that time after the parking lot show is really when Todd P kind of took over, took the reins from whoever that was who actually did put on the parking lot show.
Oh, okay.
And was kind of like took over that world of doing all the DIY shows.
Yeah.
You know, weird. He would like rent out the Polish National Home or whatever, which eventually became Warsaw, the real venue. Or he would rent out random, you know, like Elks Lodges or whatever. And
yeah, Silent Barn, stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Do that, stuff in, yeah. In punk houses and things like that.
Yeah. And I don't know that anyone, yeah, there must've been people that kind of, I think there's like a lot of like bands that are below the, like there's like the band, there's like this era of like gang dance, stuff like that. Except,
well, that was that also
kind of weird worlds. Yeah.
I guess that's all loosely kind of
electro clash, maybe.
Well, no, I mean, I hate to say freak folk for
okay
gang dance because Acceptor, they would never,
maybe. Yeah,
Acceptor definitely. I mean, Animal Collective to some degree. Devendra was around playing a lot of shows,
mm-hmm.
But he was not really. I think he lived in New York for a minute, but he was mainly a Bay Area guy.
Yeah, the weird folk stuff I felt like was a lot of like Massachusetts, Vermont kind of. Like Sunburned and people like that.
Yeah. But then, and then you also had the West Coast contingent, which is like Joanna Newsom and right. Devendra.
We're starting new documentary ideas, by the way. These are all pitches for new documentary ideas. Someone do something about Nevada City's long history of weirdos. Yeah.
So basically so far we have the Providence one, the Freak Folk one and the Electro Clash one. They could all be documentaries.
Yeah, I'm sort of thinking there was a few bands that were like also. I remember seeing this band. I mean, like Black Dice, I would see like every time they played in New York, also in that time period, because like every time you saw them, it was going to be slightly different.
It was always different.
There was always a chunk, and there was always like a little chunk of things happening around Black Dice. Well, the first Animal Collective show, I think, was a Black Dice show.
They probably opened for Black Dice for the very first. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like an AB Terror Panda Bear show. Mm-hmm.
I saw them play like in somebody's living room.
Black Dice.
No, Animal Collective. Oh, Animal AB Terror, an AB mm-hmm. Terror Panda Bear show. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then like the record stores are not like, you know, like there was like obviously the Other Music Doc is a good complement to this. If you liked the Other Music Doc, you'll probably like stuff about this doc. I'm just thinking back, like there is like, okay, I think there was a demarcation of like punk not really being part of this scene, or like some of these people came from punk, but it's like it's not the same as the hardcore scene or the ABC No Rio scene or anything like that. That's I think where it became like where there's like if you were there was still a pretty active like punk scene that was like in New York punk scene that was happening, and like this was like sort of a parallel thing that just like overshadowed all that stuff.
Totally separate. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not really the same thing at all. Yeah. Different venues, different infrastructure. But
the other funny thing is I don't really think like LCD and DFA were really that tied in with the rest of these bands. I mean, really they were all kind of on their own little islands in a way, but LCD really didn't have much to do with the rest of this. They kind of get,
they came later for sure.
Well, the timing was similar, but I mean, LCD got a lot bigger later, mm-hmm. But I mean, they were all kind of new entities around the same time in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think I saw one of the first proper LCD full band live shows was at Bowery Ballroom. Mm-hmm. There's a show that's in the film that was earlier than that. It was the very first show.
Oh yeah, that was I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that stuff. I find him pretty compelling. He is as curmudgeonly as he is, maybe because he is curmudgeonly, and everyone else seems so kind of wide eyed, and he's just a sort of like stark, like you know, like cynical kind of figure.
Yeah,
and he's even not that cynical. Like he's like becomes like a believer kind of. He's like a dance music believer. He kind of has a conversion. He has the most kind of evolution of him, of himself, I think, mm-hmm. in the film. It's very clearly there's like this, but also they were very close to him because they made that other film with him. So like the filmmakers obviously have like a lot of insight into the James Murphy stuff. So like, yeah. I found that to be like, I found it more compelling, maybe identifiable or relatable in some ways more than like Karen O for me, you know?
Yeah, I think, well, somebody else was also pointing out to me that if you really watch this, not really knowing that much about the bands, the Yeah actually come across as being the most likable group of people.
Yeah, they're just, they seem quiet and like nice, you know.
Brian Chase was a very nice guy to talk to around that time period and very approachable and friendly, and just he was also playing in all these other bands.
He's like a free jazz guy, right? Yeah,
an excellent jazz drummer, and was I think he's still putting out jazz records that he plays drums on or his own solo stuff. Anyway, so I mean, I do think that as musicians, they're really good. They're very talented. And I think a lot of people just really were rooting for them to make it.
For Yeah Yeahs?
You know, and a lot of, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're like one of the bands that you're kind of like, you know, I want to see these three become the biggest band in the world.
Mm-hmm. For a movie called Meet Me in the Bathroom, which sort of has a lot of connotations, I think there's like not much drug talk till kind of near the end. And this is where maybe we can talk about Ryan Adams.
Yeah, sure. So the part in the book lines up pretty well with the way they talk about it in the movie. Although I don't remember the line where it was like, you're not part of our scene anymore. I think the breakdown is that Julian finds out that Ryan had supplied Albert with heroin, or got him hooked on heroin, or blames him for being hooked on heroin. And then they decide to have a confrontation with Ryan Adams in a bar. Like, pretty much the whole band shows up and tells him, like we're
stay away from our friend.
Like, yeah. Stay away from our friend. We're cutting you off. Like, that's it. We're done with you. Which maybe is like a, also like, oh, these guys knew that he was bad news way before the rest of the world found out.
I was gonna say, like, I've heard some second hands, but like pretty gnarly Ryan M stuff.
I
didn't know he was a heroin guy though, and I didn't know that about Albert Hammond either. So like, yeah, it's sort of like only, that's the only kind of like druggy kind of references I think that are, I guess Julian, I assume it's like he's doing coke or something, that's
right,
the stuff that's referenced earlier. But yeah, I thought that that would be more part of the story. Is it more part of the book, like debauchery?
I think, yeah, not too much more. I mean, there's a little bit more of talking about like the after party scene that Interpol was kind of like the ringleaders of. I mean,
oh really? It sounds like Carlos. Yeah, Carlos was the party animal of Interpol.
He was definitely. Yeah, or the man about town. It like we were talking about earlier, like you would just see him everywhere you went. Mm-hmm. If you were hanging out in the Lower East Side, especially, which is where I lived, I would see him all the time.
This holster.
The holster. Yeah. And then he left the band. Like, and then everyone was kind of like, yeah, and then everyone was kind of like, what happened to him?
His bass playing is very good on when they show him just playing. I'm like, this is like Duran Duran or something. He's like a sick bass player.
Yeah. But yeah, there's a little bit more in the book about the after hours scene that all these people were, you know, part of. And but it doesn't really, I mean, I guess if you don't really have somebody ODing or getting busted for dealing, it becomes a little less interesting. Like, yeah, everyone was doing drugs. So,
yeah, this is where I find like the film as a story, it's like a bunch of people being successful, getting successful. And the conflict, the conflicts are sometimes like, there's less internal conflict and just like, it's sort of like the part of every rock biopic is like, it's like rock stardom starts to feel boring kind of thing is what happens mm-hmm. a lot of the time. I mean,
although they don't really get to that part of the story, you know, I mean, yeah. This is such a document of youth. And there's somebody, one of the reviews, it might have been Pitchfork, actually, talked about how, you know, you see only archival footage of all these people in their early 20s, mostly, other mm-hmm. than James Murphy. But you're seeing everybody in, like, this eternal youthful glow. Yeah. No one ages in the film. You don't see anyone, like, because you... In a lot of rock docs, you'll see that archival footage juxtaposed with how they look now.
Yeah, right.
But
good point.
They took that element out completely by not filming anything new.
Oh, that's
So you've got everybody encased in amber, as it were. You know, you've got they're all still 24 in their prime, the best looking state of their life or whatever. So
exactly. I was thinking that maybe I didn't dig in to find the answer to this. I'm wondering if some of the interviews, like some of the interviews that are on phone, I wonder if those are like Lizzie Goodman's own.
Oh, they are. Yeah.
So that's that. All that audio is from that. Cause that's what's getting me thinking too. Like that was the other reason why they wouldn't have Talking Heads. Cause like, this was a book project. This wasn't fully like thought through to be like, let's also capture this on video when they were doing the interviews.
Yeah.
So that's another aspect of, like, the voices are current ish but like all the footage ish. Yeah, like, so yeah. It's like archival footage, but then like the interviews that are from the book directly. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say
so you hear the disembodied voice of Julian on tape talking about things, but you don't actually see him now saying these things,
right? And it gives you that kind of like that's you're right. Everyone still looks good.
No one is given the chance to age or get bored or talk about how, you know, what it's like to be a band 20 years in.
Right. Right. Cause that's not what this is about, but then also it does like feel like the end feels abrupt because then you just get like the end is just, oh, let's just play that loop of the poem from the beginning.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like, they, how do you get out of this? Because like, yeah, then everyone was pretty successful. I think Kimia Dawson's like life seems very dramatic, and following her on social media, it seems like there's a lot going on with her, but she seems very happy to be kind of back in the conversation, and like Moldy Peaches is gonna play shows again, I guess, partly because of this film coming out. Mm-hmm. That was the impression I was getting. Dan, would you say for someone who's not inherently like of the era where these bands were like, you know, new to them and like they don't have like a context of being around New York, would you recommend it to like, I don't know, someone who's like 22 or to someone who's like, I don't know, 60?
I thought about what I was going to say for this. So I think what I have to say is read the book.
The book's better than the film. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting from a lot of what I've heard about this. Yeah.
But, you know, if you happen to have Showtime, it's worth a watch. I didn't have Showtime, so I got a screener.
Yeah, screener. Yeah, it's on Showtime now.
But it's on Showtime now, and I eventually maybe it'll end up, if you have a way to watch it on, you know, some streaming platform where you don't have to pay, it's probably worth the hour and a half. So I guess if you like reliving the glory days of you know what? Another important thing I was talking to somebody about. How did this happen in New York at this time period? It was pre-iPhone.
Right.
Okay, so like the iPhone came out in 2006.
Yeah.
I believe. It was the same year I started my company. 06, I think. So, you know, at the time that this was all happening, people only really had the ability to like maybe take photos on their phone or text, and that's it. Mm. You weren't looking at your phone all the goddamn time.
right.
So, you know.
Friendster era rock.
It was MySpace and Friendster were the only social media. And then I guess like the dating sites had started to pop up. But other than that, I mean, you know, Life it was journal, still a very, yeah. it was still a very, like, the internet was not your whole life. So,
right. You had to, you know, and also like the regionalism was maybe more important then, right? Like, I think now yeah. it's like we think like, I can hear about a band, some weird band from Florida on Bandcamp, or you can find about some weird band from Scandinavia. But it was like, I did feel like people like in New York had a leg up because there was more media there and there was more way to disseminate things. But if you were in like, you know, Idaho, like good luck getting discovered by anyone in the music industry, you know?
Yeah. I mean, no, there were bands moving to New York rapidly around that time period. Cause I mean, especially like 2004 to 2009, I think like there was like, okay, if you want to be in the center of the world, you have to go to New York.
Yeah. And then there's like a lot of, I guess my sort of like my world of like knowing about this stuff, like the sort of Todd P level bands where it's like Japanther is like the Strokes of a bike punks or something, you know, like that's like right. the sub level, or like Dan Deacon maybe is like another person who like kind of came out of that Todd P world. But yeah, I mean,
well, that's Baltimore, so that's a whole that's other documentary.
Yes, there is definitely a documentary maybe about Baltimore. But like, yeah, I feel like there was also like a continuum of like Philly, Baltimore, Providence bands all kind of coming through because it's a lot closer to do that on the East Coast.
Yeah. For sure. So I mean, I think we're talking about New York being like the center of everything. I think that was kind of like what they were trying to hint at by having that intro be the intro and the outro. It was like, we were inspired by the, you know,
the
classic
beats.
New York, the classic New York bands, the late 70s, early 80s. And then now because of these bands, you know, New York lives on as being like, music central or whatever. Yeah. I don't know. That's
the Rapture is Television. The Strokes are the Ramones. I don't know. Like the Yeahs are Blondie. I don't know. Just like there's like these parallels you can make. Who is Talking Heads though? I don't know. I guess Vampire Weekend is Talking Heads. That comes later.
Dirty Projectors.
Yeah. There's, I mean, this is like, it's kind of fun to think about this time period. And for, I think for you and me.
Oh, I guess maybe Liars. Liars or Dirty Projectors.
I feel like the one time I've seen Liars, which was like a little bit, is definitely past this period. I'm like, oh, this band is like good and interesting and trying new things all the time. And I like that about the Liars. You know, I feel like they always are kind of like evolving a little bit.
Yeah, so. Every record is different. They would kind of reinvent themselves every record, kind of, you know. I really liked the first three records. Were all I saw them live on each of those tours. It was very different each time. I liked all of them.
Yeah.
And a lot of people probably like kind of fell off the bandwagon after they stopped being dance punk.
Yeah, they got pretty weird out there.
Yeah.
Also, I guess like someone at Showtime, do you want to do a 7-part docuseries about Sightings? I would watch that. me and that's for me and Chris Weingarten. That's basically the two people that will watch that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's fun to talk about this period of time in music, and like I do have nostalgia about that era, but like, you know, like to me, these bands were like already like such givens, and like I don't even think about them. They're like Oxygen, you know, and like, so it's interesting to like go back and like kind of get their insights into things. I do think like, yeah, like the James Murphy stuff is the stuff that kind of is most relatable to me. I should watch that other film they made.
You didn't ever watch the LCD film?
I never watched it, so I should
watch that. So that's basically just a concert film. But it's very well done. I liked it a lot. I believe Arcade Fire opened the show. And so they're kind of in it as well.
Yeah.
But The footage is great. It's very well produced as a standalone document of that time period. It's really good. And I think that is available on Netflix if anyone wants to watch that. So, I mean, going back to, do we recommend the film? Did you, what is your take? Did you say?
I think if you're like in your 40s or 30s, maybe it's got a more like you'll remember this time before the iPhone a little bit better. And it might be like, feel like just like, I don't know. I was talking to a lot of people about this when I first saw it, cause I didn't know how I felt about it. I just watched it again and I'm like, I have criticisms, but I do feel like it's like an entertaining entryway into this world. So yeah, like you're making me want to read the book. I think like the stuff I'm more interested in is probably going to be in the book. I think this is a good kind of survey, but like, I was talking to Paco about this and he's like, I don't know these bands. I'm like, yeah, you probably are not going to like this if you don't like these bands at all, or you don't know these bands at all. I don't think it's going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, like, not, yeah.
If you're not at least a fan of one of these bands, then you are not going to care.
I think if you, I mean, like, look, like Maps is a very good song and there's like a cool scene from Maps, but then like, I think it's like, you have to like at least one of these bands. And even like, I didn't think of myself as a Strokes fan, but I'm like, yeah, like they have a formula, but it works. Like everything is like formulaic that they do, but they do it very well. And I appreciate that about them. Yeah.
I also learned one thing from this film that I did not really know. Yeah, and having been a pretty like big Strokes fan, I saw the Strokes on the day that Is This It came out in America.
Oh, wow.
But they were playing in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, right.
That's where the show was. It was Strokes and Moldy Peaches, but it was the same day their album came out. It was that day. So, you know, things were already happening. I mean, they were already at the stage where they were selling out a show in Boulder, Colorado. So like the hype was already there.
Nice.
But as a Strokes fan, I did not realize that they kind of talk in the film about how Julian was the Strokes. Like it was purely his vision, even though the other guys are kind of, you know, in the press or whatever, like, or in the imagery of the Strokes kind of given equal footing as being important parts of the band. Like he kind of ruled over that band with an iron fist. Even like, so they talk about, you know, the scene where Albert says, I had a song that I thought might work as a Strokes song. I tried to take it to Julian. He says, nope, no way.
Like, I showed it to Ryan Adams.
So I think I learned that about the Strokes. I didn't realize. And then I kind of didn't really make sense why he has his solo project and the Voids, because if Strokes is already basically just him, why does he have, you know, another band?
Julian has another band?
Yeah, he has a solo record. And then he had, after that, it was called Julian Casablancas and the Voids.
Probably contractual stuff or something.
I think he just constantly writing and constant just has too many songs, or wanted to do stuff that wasn't quite poppy enough to be considered, you know, right for the Strokes, and wanted to have another lane for that. But the first Julian solo record is essentially a, you know, just a little bit more synth driven Strokes record.
Oh, cool.
It's very good.
I'll check it out. Yeah,
it's good. It's
check
very
out these
good.
Bands check out Interpol. Interpol wrote some good British songs by an American band.
They were a great Joy Division tribute band.
I was gonna say, yeah, like definitely. But yeah, Dan, thanks for talking to us about Meet Me in the Bathroom. I think we both like would like it's a qualified recommendation. It's like, yes, only you have to like this or be interested in it. If you're totally not down, if you hate Maps, you won't like this documentary.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But yeah, the book has a lot of juicy stuff in it, and it's very well put together, and it is a very quick read, at least if you're like me. I tore through the book.
Dan, so I don't tear through any books. Like I have Wasu's book, and I'm like, I've read 50 pages of it. I'm like, wait, I'm just going to email this guy. I'm like, we have too many weird life similarities.
Right.
But yeah, thanks for coming on SupDoc again, Dan. You're like, you're my new Paco.
No. Don't say that. I don't want Paco mad at me. No, Paco. I'm not trying to.
You're my indie rock Paco.
Okay.
We'll take that. Okay, cool. Talk to you soon. Yes. Thanks, everyone.
Yep. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com. Our theme music was written by David Siegel. Donate to the show through our Patreon page. patreon.com/supdocpodcast. If you want to help out in other ways, please share this show with a friend. Find Paco and George's comedy gigs on the About Us page on our site. SupDoc is by doc fans for doc fans, so if you want to advertise, got a film, or opinions to share, hit us up. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.